Chapter 33.
When do you expect him back? He asked. After he brought you here, he rode off to fetch the senior doctor from the town for mother. He will be back soon. He stands a good chance of getting shot somewhere on the road, Deckard murmured to himself audibly, and Linda declared in her high-pitched voice, nobody would dare to fire a shot at Guy and Batista.
You believe that? Asked Deckard. Do you?
I know it, said the child, with conviction. T, there is no one in this place brave enough to attack Guy and Batista.
It doesn't require much bravery to pull a trigger behind a bush, muttered Deckard to himself.
Fortunately, the night is dark, or there would be but little chance of saving the silver of the mine. He turned again to his pocketbook, glanced back through the pages, and again started his pencil. That was the position yesterday, after the Minerva with the fugitive president had gone out of harbor, and the rioters had been driven back into the side lanes of the town. I sat on the steps of the cathedral with Nostromo, after sending out the cable message for the information of a more or less attentive world. Strangely enough, though the offices of the cable company are in the same building as the Porvenir, the mob, which has thrown my presses out of the window and scattered the type all over the plaza, has been kept from interfering with the instruments on the other side of the courtyard. As I sat talking with Nostromo, Bernard, the telegraphist, came out from under the arcades with a piece of paper in his hand. The little man had tied himself up to an enormous sword, and was hung all over with revolvers. He is ridiculous, but the bravest German of his size that ever tapped the key of a Morse transmitter. He had received the message from Cater reporting the transports with Berio's army just entering the port, and ending with the words, the greatest enthusiasm prevails. I walked off to drink some water at the fountain, and I was shot at from the Alameda by somebody hiding behind a tree. But I drank, and didn't care, with Berio's in Cata and the great Cordillera between us, and Montero's victorious army I seemed, notwithstanding Messrs. Gamacho and Fuentes, to hold my new state in the hollow of my hand. I was ready to sleep, but when I got as far as the Casa Gould I found the patio full of wounded laid out on straw. Lights were burning, and in that enclosed courtyard on that hot night a faint odor of chloroform and blood hung about. At one end Dr. Monaghan, the doctor of the mine, was dressing the wounds. At the other, near the stairs, Father Corbelin, kneeling, listened to the confession of a dying cargador. Mrs. Gould was walking about through these shambles with a large bottle in one hand, and a lot of cotton wool in the other. She just looked at me, and never even winked. Her camarista was following her, also holding a bottle, and sobbing gently to herself. I busied myself for some time in fetching water from the cistern for the wounded. Afterwards I wandered upstairs, meeting some of the first ladies of Sulaco, paler than I had ever seen them before, with bandages over their arms. Not all of them had fled to the ships. A good many had taken refuge for the day in the Casa Gould. On the landing a girl, with her hair half down, was kneeling against the wall under the niche, where stands a Madonna in blue robes, and a gilt crown on her head. I think it was the eldest Miss Lopez. I couldn't see her face, but I remember looking at the high French heel of her little shoe. She did not make a sound, she did not stir, she was not sobbing, she remained there, perfectly still, all black against the white wall, a silent figure of passionate piety. I am sure she was no more frightened than the other white-faced ladies I met carrying bandages. One was sitting on the top step tearing a piece of linen hastily in two strips, the young wife of an elderly man of fortune here. She interrupted herself to wave her hand to my bow, as though she were in her carriage on the Alameda. The women of our country are worth looking at during a revolution. The rouge and pearl powder fall off, together with that passive attitude towards the outer world which education, tradition, custom impose upon them from the earliest infancy. I thought of your face, which from your infancy had the stamp of intelligence instead of that patient and resigned cast which appears when some political commotion tears down the veil of cosmetics and usage. In the great sal upstairs a sort of junta of notables was sitting, the remnant of the vanished provincial assembly. Don Juste Lopez had had half his beard singed off at the muzzle of a trabuco loaded with slugs, of which everyone missed him, providentially. And as he turned his head from side to side it was exactly as if there had been two men inside his frock coat, one nobly whiskered and solemn, the other untidy and scared. They raised a cry of decade. Don Martin! Apostrophe at my entrance. I asked them, what are you deliberating upon, gentlemen? Apostrophe, apostrophe, there did not seem to be any president, though Don Jose Avellano sat at the head of the table. They all answered together, on the preservation of life and property. Apostrophe, apostrophe, till the new officials arrive, apostrophe, Don Juste explained to me, with the solemn side of his face offered to my view. It was as if a stream of water had been poured upon my glowing idea of a new state. There was a hissing sound in my ears, and the room grew dim, as if suddenly filled with vapor. I walked up to the table blindly, as though I had been drunk. You are deliberating upon surrender, apostrophe, I said. They all sat still, with their noses over the sheet of paper each had before him, God only knows why. Only Don Jose hid his face in his hands, muttering, never, never. Apostrophe, apostrophe, but as I looked at him, it seemed to me that I could have blown him away with my breath. He looked so frail, so weak, so worn out. Whatever happens, he will not survive. The deception is too great for a man of his age. And hasn't he seen the sheets of 50 years of misrule, apostrophe, which we have begun printing on the presses of the Porvenir, littering the plaza, floating in the gutters, fired out as wads for trabucos loaded with handfuls of type, blown in the wind, trampled in the mud? I have seen pages floating upon the very waters of the harbor. It would be unreasonable to expect him to survive. It would be cruel. Do you know, apostrophe, I cried, what surrender means to you, to your women, to your children, to your property? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I declaimed for 5 minutes without drawing breath. It seems to me, harping on our best chances, on the ferocity of Montero, whom I made out to be as great a beast as I have no doubt he would like to be if he had intelligence enough to conceive a systematic reign of terror. And then for another 5 minutes or more I poured out an impassioned appeal to their courage and manliness, with all the passion of my love for Antonia. For if ever man spoke well, it would be from a personal feeling, denouncing an enemy, defending himself, or pleading for what really may be dearer than life. My dear girl, I absolutely thundered at them. It seemed as if my voice would burst the walls asunder, and when I stopped I saw all their scared eyes looking at me dubiously. And that was all the effect I had produced. Only Don Jose's head had sunk lower and lower on his breast. I bent my ear to his withered lips, and made out his whisper, something like, in God's name, then, Martin, my son. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I don't know exactly. There was the name of God in it, I am certain. It seems to me, I have caught his last breath, the breath of his departing soul on his lips. He lives yet, it is true. I have seen him since, but it was only a senile body, lying on its back, covered to the chin, with open eyes, and so still, that you might have said it was breathing no longer. I left him thus, with Antonia kneeling by the side of the bed, just before I came to this Italian's posada, where the ubiquitous death is also waiting. But I know that Don Jose has really died there, in the Casa Gould, with that whisper urging me to attempt what no doubt his soul, wrapped up in the sanctity of diplomatic treaties and solemn declarations, must have abhorred. I had exclaimed very loud, there is never any God in a country where men will not help themselves. Apostrophe, apostrophe, meanwhile, Don Juste had begun a pondered oration whose solemn effect was spoiled by the ridiculous disaster to his beard. I did not wait to make it out. He seemed to argue that Montero's, he called him the general, intentions were probably not evil, though, he went on, that distinguished man, only a week ago we used to call him a grand bestia, was perhaps mistaken, as to the true means. ... As you may imagine, I didn't stay to hear the rest. I know the intentions of Montero's brother, Pedrito, the guerrillero, whom I exposed in Paris, some years ago, in a café frequented by South American students, where he tried to pass himself off for a secretary of legation. He used to come in and talk for hours, twisting his felt hat in his hairy paws, and his ambition seemed to become a sort of Duc de Morny to a sort of Napoleon. Already then, he used to talk of his brother in inflated terms. He seemed fairly safe from being found out, because the students, all of the Blanco families, did not, as you may imagine, frequent the legation. It was only Decad, a man without faith and principles, as they used to say, that went in there sometimes for the sake of the fun, as it were to an assembly of trained monkeys. I know his intentions. I have seen him change the plates at table. Whoever is allowed to live on in terror, I must die the death. No, I didn't stay to the end, to hear Don Juste Lopez trying, to persuade himself in a grave oration of the clemency and justice, and honesty, and purity of the brothers Montero. I went out abruptly to seek Antonia. I saw her in the gallery. As I opened the door, she extended to me her clasped hands. What are they doing in there? ... she asked. Talking, ... I said, with my eyes looking into hers. Yes, yes, but ... empty speeches, ... I interrupted her. Hiding their fears behind imbecile hopes. They are all great parliamentarians there on the English model, as you know. ... I was so furious, that I could hardly speak. She made a gesture of despair. Through the door I held a little ajar behind me, we heard Don Juste's measured mouthing monotone go on from phrase to phrase, like a sort of awful and solemn madness. After all, the democratic aspirations have, perhaps, their legitimacy. The ways of human progress are inscrutable, and if the fate of the country is in the hand of Montero, we ought ... I crashed the door to on that. It was enough. It was too much. There was never a beautiful face expressing more horror and despair than the face of Antonia. I couldn't bear it. I seized her wrists. Have they killed my father in there? ... she asked. Her eyes blazed with indignation, but as I looked on, fascinated, the light in them went out. It is a surrender, ... I said. And I remember I was shaking her wrists I held apart in my hands. But it's more than talk. Your father told me to go on in God's name. ... my dear girl, there is that in Antonia which would make me believe in the feasibility of anything. One look at her face is enough to set my brain on fire. And yet I love her as any other man would with the heart, and with that alone. She is more to me than his church to Father Corbelin.
The Grand Vicar disappeared last night from the town. Perhaps gone to join the band of Hernandez.
She is more to me than his precious mind to that sentimental Englishman. I won't speak of his wife. She may have been sentimental once. The Saint-Homme mind stands now between those two people. Your father himself, Antonia, ... I repeated. Your father, do you understand, has told me to go on. ... she averted her face, and in a pained voice, he has? ... she cried. Then, indeed, I fear he will never speak again. ... she freed her wrists from my clutch, and began to cry in her handkerchief. I disregarded her sorrow. I would rather see her miserable than not see her at all, never anymore. For whether I escaped or stayed to die, there was for us no coming together, no future. And that being so, I had no pity to waste upon the passing moments of her sorrow. I sent her off in tears to fetch Dona Emilia and Don Carlos too. Their sentiment was necessary to the very life of my plan. the sentimentalism of the people that will never do anything for the sake of their passionate desire unless it comes to them clothed in the fair robes of an idea. Late at night we formed a small junta of four: the two women, Don Carlos, and myself in Mrs. Gould's blue and white boudoir. El Rey de Sulaco thinks himself, no doubt, a very honest man. And so he is, if one could look behind his taciturnity. Perhaps he thinks that this alone makes his honesty unstained. Those Englishmen live on illusions which somehow or other help them to get a firm hold of the substance. When he speaks, it is by a rare yes or no that seems as impersonal as the words of an oracle. But he could not impose on me by his dumb reserve. I knew what he had in his head. He has his mind in his head. And his wife had nothing in her head but his precious person, which he has bound up with the Gould concession and tied up to that little woman's neck. No matter. The thing was to make him present the affair to Holrud, the steel and silver king, in such a manner as to secure his financial support. At that time last night, just 24 hours ago, we thought the silver of the mine safe in the custom house vaults till the northbound steamer came to take it away. And as long as the treasure flowed north, without a break, that utter sentimentalist, Holrud, would not drop his idea of introducing, not only justice, industry, peace, to the benighted continents, but also that pet dream of his of a pure form of Christianity. Later on, the principal European really in Sulaco, the engineer-in-chief of the railway, came riding up the calle from the harbor and was admitted to our conclave. Meantime, the junta of the notables in the great sala was still deliberating. Only, one of them had run out in the corridor to ask the servant whether something to eat couldn't be sent in. The first words the engineer-in-chief said as he came into the boudoir were, "What is your house, dear Mrs. Gould?" "A war hospital below, and apparently a restaurant above. I saw them carrying trays full of good things into the sala." "And here, in this boudoir, I said, "you behold the inner cabinet of the Occidental Republic that is to be." He was so preoccupied that he didn't smile at that. He didn't even look surprised. He told us that he was attending to the general dispositions for the defense of the railway property at the railway yards when he was sent for to go into the railway telegraph office. The engineer of the railhead, at the foot of the mountains, wanted to talk to him from his end of the wire. There was nobody in the office but himself and the operator of the railway telegraph, who read off the clicks aloud as the tape coiled its length upon the floor. And the purport of that talk, clicked nervously from a wooden shed in the depths of the forests, had informed the chief that President Rubira had been, or was being, pursued. This was news, indeed, to all of us in Sulaco. Rubira himself, when rescued, revived, and soothed by us, had been inclined to think that he had not been pursued. Rubira had yielded to the urgent solicitations of his friends, and had left the headquarters of his discomfited army alone. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.